Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And here's something I learned recently. James E. Bothberg has a wicked sense of humor. Wait. Let me back up for a moment, because I imagine you're asking, who is James Bothberg? All right. He's a federal judge. He serves on the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, which is kind of a big deal job because 8 judges from the D.C. Circuit eventually went on to become justices on the Supreme Court. Jurists including Chief Justice Warren Burger, the notorious Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and conservative superstars Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas, John Roberts, and Brett Kavanaugh. But back to Bothberg. Turns out he's funny. I mean, I wouldn't have expected it because typically he sounds like a pretty straightforward guy. Here he is in a 2021 video produced by the United States courts to celebrate Constitution Day.
What's unique about the American constitutional system and its checks and balances is that, unlike in foreign countries, judges here are appointed for life. As a result, we are under no political pressure from whatever ruling party may govern to follow that party's wishes.
But just beneath that heard it all before judicial seriousness beats the heart of a comedian. See, back in 2021, Bothberg dismissed an antitrust case brought by the Federal Trade Commission against Facebook. But last week, Bothberg gave the FTC the green light to proceed. And he did so with really colorful language. His opinion begins, "Second time lucky." No, seriously, those are the first 3 words of the opinion. Second time lucky. He continues, "The Federal Trade Commission's first antitrust suit against Facebook Incorporated stumbled out of the starting blocks last June." Oh, that's gotta hurt. But then he goes on to explain that, quote, "The court left ajar for the agency to amend the complaint and reinstate the suit. Eagerly accepting such an invitation, the FTC has filed an amended complaint." Can't you just see the eager Fed regulators bursting through the slightly propped judicial door with their new filing?
Oh, yeah!
A bit later in the decision, Judge Bothberg straight clowns Facebook by writing, "The company let fly a new arrow this time around. The court believes it misses the target." Burn! And he winds up with this zinger. Whether the FTC will be able to prove its case at summary judgment and trial is anyone's guess. Okay. I know it's not exactly Def Comedy Jam, but it's not every day that a district court opinion paints such a distinct and colorful picture of an eager government prosecutor and an arrogant corporate giant. And I, for one, appreciate Judge Bothberg dropping some nerdy legal giggles in the midst of this very serious matter. It's something Senator Lindsey Graham managed back in 2018 when he asked Mark Zuckerberg to name his biggest competitor during a Senate Judiciary and Commerce Committee hearing.
Who's your biggest competitor?
Senator, we have a lot of competitors.
Who's your biggest?
I think the categories of... Do you want just one? I'm not sure I can give one, but can I give a bunch?
Eventually, Senator Graham just got straight to the point by asking Zuckerberg whether Facebook is a monopoly.
Is it an alternative to Facebook in the private sector?
Yes, Senator. The average American uses 8 different apps to communicate with their friends and stay in touch with people, ranging from texting apps to email.
It's the same service you provide.
Well, we provide a number of different services.
Is Twitter the same as what you do?
It overlaps with a portion of what we do.
You don't think you have a monopoly?
It certainly doesn't feel like that to me.
Okay.
So Bothberg's decision is a major step forward for regulators like the FTC, which has long been a critic of the practices of tech giants like Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And the judge managed to do it with a little bit of style. But what it will all mean for the substance of monopolies and tech? Well, to quote the judge himself, that's anyone's guess. Here to break down the lawsuit and antitrust laws is Rebecca Allensworth, professor at Vanderbilt Law School.
Antitrust law is the law of competition. It's what businesses can and can't do when they're competing with each other. What are the rules of the road? What goes too far?
I feel like our antitrust laws, and even as you say, sort of business and competition, that there's kind of a maybe even 19th, but certainly 20th century vision of that, as though there's like, you know, two hardware stores next to each other and the, you know, the sort of preserving competition between hardware store A and B. But that it, maybe those antitrust laws didn't imagine the 21st century realities of modern tech businesses.
I think there's a lot of power to that narrative. I mean, the main statute that we use to bring big tech companies to heel, I mean, the statute that's cited in all these current cases was passed in 1890. At the same time, the law has evolved through interpretation in the courts and was used in 2001 against a tech company doing things that are really quite similar to what's happening today. So I think that on the one hand, you're right that we have old law and an old law that was built up around what we call kind of smokestack industries, you know, maybe the hardware store, maybe aluminum. And at the same time, I think that there are places where it's evolved to be more responsive to what we see today.
What led us initially as a nation to needing the antitrust laws? What were the trusts that were considered most problematic?
Well, there was Standard Oil, which was an oil monopoly, essentially. There were the railroads. And it's conventional to talk about these things like they're monolithic, easy to imagine monopolies. And so we had to have trust busting against them. And it was easy because we could just break them up. And now different oil companies have to compete with each other. I think when you scratch beneath the surface, you'll see that even Standard Oil was a pretty complicated network of properties that related to each other in vertical ways. The railroads actually are really complicated because you've got network effects there too. So this is why I say there's power to that narrative that, oh, our antitrust laws are not prepared to take on this kind of networked techie thing. But then there's also this counter narrative that maybe business has always been somewhat like this and antitrust laws have always been somewhat prepared to deal with it. The real problem may be what happened in the 70s and since then in the way that the courts have interpreted these antitrust laws.
So let's talk about this recent decision by a federal judge. What does it mean for the Federal Trade Commission's case against Facebook?
The recent decision says it can go ahead. So in some ways, it means everything for their case. It's a necessary, but of course, not sufficient step in the direction of a winning case against Facebook and some real changes there.
But this is the same judge, right, who initially said that FTC had failed to provide sufficient evidence. So what was different this time?
That's right. And, you know, when I read his first opinion, I thought, oh, this is really rough. You know, it's getting dismissed and there's all kinds of skepticism in this. And then he comes out with this opinion where he says, oh, no, I always said that the market definition was fine and I didn't address any of the competitive conduct. I was just worried about this narrow question of within the market of personal networking services, what is Facebook's share? The FTC has to tell me what their share is and how they got it, at least an estimate of it. And that was the flaw that caused him to dismiss the first complaint. And the FTC came back and provided an estimate of that share and why they thought that the number was what it was. And he accepted that. And so rereading that old opinion by him that I had read as so damning, it actually isn't that damning. Really, it says what he says it said, which is the real problem is you haven't told me how much of this market Facebook has.
Let's talk a little bit about that. What is the antitrust case against Facebook? And also maybe why are regulators pursuing it and continuing to pursue it even when, you know, they met big roadblocks like the previous ruling?
Well, I think the reason why they're still pursuing it is fairly obvious. It's both, I think, a good suit that has a lot of legs. Whether they will succeed or not is unclear, but it's certainly worth pursuing. And also there's a political problem if you bring a suit, it's dismissed, but without prejudice. You're sort of invited to replete it, and then you give up. You look like you've sort of rolled over in the face of big tech. So just politically, they're not going to do that. So they're making the claim that Facebook acquired Instagram and WhatsApp in order to forestall future competition from those companies, and that by doing so, they violated the Sherman Act, which prohibits monopolization. Monopolization is obtaining, or in this case, really more accurately, defending your monopoly by doing certain unlawful business practices.
So our production team is sitting down and we're, you know, talking about what we're going to have conversation about. And I was like, yeah. And you know what? When we leave this conversation, I'm going to go plan my Facebook Live for later in the month. So,
yeah.
So it always, I always feel this kind of ickiness in my belly as we are simultaneously wanting to cover the ways that monopolistic behavior on the part of Facebook might be harming consumers as well as rival companies, and also going and making use of Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram. Should I be feeling guilty, or is that actually the evidence of the monopoly itself?
I don't think you need to feel guilty. I think the fact that you have to go from doing this to go doing a Facebook Live thing is evidence that you don't really have a lot of options. You know everything you know about Facebook. You know all the bad things probably. And yet, what are you going to do? This is your avenue to your audience. This is your way of communicating with the world. And it is for so many people in so many contexts that you're not given a choice. And that kind of fundamentally is what antitrust cares about. And it's the way it's that consumer choice idea is the mechanism of competition. I don't like what you're doing, so I'm going to go to your competitor. Your prices are too high. Your privacy policy sucks. I'm going to switch. And I think fundamentally, that's what Zuckerberg was worried about in 2012, that Instagram and later WhatsApp could become that place that people might switch to.
That helps me understand in part the way that it harms consumers, right? If I can't opt out. So how's that different from the fact that I can't change my cable company either because there's only one that serves my community?
I mean, antitrust wouldn't see those things as particularly different. I mean, if there's only one company that can serve your community for cable, they, have monopoly power. And then antitrust goes further and says monopoly power isn't unlawful. It's anti-competitive acts that maintain it or create it. And so if your cable company did things to make sure nobody else came into that neighborhood or other sort of predatory tactics, they too would be liable. Antitrust kind of doesn't care how like crucial or central or important. I mean, I'm not saying your cable isn't important. We all want our cable TV, but they treat all markets kind of alike. I think part of why these cases are so high profile is because they are so much a part of our day-to-day and they're increasingly being seen as really essential. But that fact isn't particularly relevant in a formal way to the antitrust analysis.
Are there rival companies? I mean, and if there aren't, is it because of Facebook or is that because in other words, is that necessarily evidence that Facebook has engaged in particular kinds of monopolistic behavior or might it be that they're just really way far ahead and much smarter and better than anyone else and rivals have not been able to emerge?
This is not going to be a big part of the antitrust analysis because antitrust cares about the process of competition, not about the outcome so much. But there is a way in which Facebook is not a great product. My personal experience of it is that it doesn't add a lot to my life. And then increasingly people are coming out and seeing the harm that it's causing and to especially young people. So, saying that they're dominant because they're awesome, I think is a little bit suspect. There's a different question though there, which is, are they dominant because the nature of a social network is you kind of have to have the whole market? There's a little bit more to this part of the argument in the sense that, having two Facebooks doesn't quite make sense. Like, oh, I'm on Facebook A. Are you on Facebook A? No, I'm on Facebook B. Okay, well, I guess we can't be friends. That's not going to work. So there's something called network effects. And when you have a market that's defined by network effects, it tends to get really big. Sometimes the competition is for the market, not within the market. And yet, and Facebook's going to make these arguments and they make them strongly. There's a problem though, because if this is true, then why does Facebook need to do all these little machinations to make sure that it stays on top? That's the problem, I think, that antitrust law can really identify here, which is, okay, fine, maybe there has to be really large economies of scale for social networking. But, that means that when Instagram starts up and starts threatening you, you got to improve your own products. You got to try to compete for that market, not swallow up Instagram to make sure you don't have to compete.
If FTC wins this, what might it mean for Meta's future? What kinds of actions could go forward?
Well, there's been a lot of talk of breaking up big tech, and I actually think Facebook may be the one company for which that would make sense in a big way, because there are these sort of natural product lines, these natural kind of points at which you could cut it off. You could spin off Instagram, you could spin off WhatsApp. It's a little unclear, though, how much that would get you. Facebook Blue, as they call it, you know, the Facebook that we all sort of know and use, would still be characterized by a lot of network effects. It would still have a huge market share. So, you know, I think a breakup in this kind of context is possible, maybe even likely if the government wins its suit, but it may mean less than we all would want it to.
Yeah, billions instead of gabillions. Thank you to Rebecca Allensworth, who is professor at Vanderbilt Law School. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. This was great.
On the far end of the Trail of Tears was a promise. That's how Justice Neil Gorsuch began his July 2020 opinion in McGirt versus Oklahoma. In that decision, Justice Gorsuch and the court's majority ruled because Congress had never disestablished the Muscogee Nation's reservation. The state of Oklahoma does not have the authority to prosecute crimes committed within the tribe's land boundaries if those crimes involve indigenous citizens. Now, the decision has since been extended to other tribes located within Oklahoma. But even though it's been a year and a half since McGirt was decided, the state of Oklahoma has remained intent on resisting the ruling rather than collaborating with the tribes on criminal justice. Speaking with Indigenous Affairs reporter Allison Herrera last summer, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt had this to say about McGirt.
The solution is Congress has got to fix it. The courts have to fix it. And those are the two things. It's complicated for Congress. So there's going to be plenty of chances for the courts to fix this because it is going to be endless litigation.
State officials have filed 45 petitions with the Supreme Court asking the justices to either overturn or rule more narrowly on McGirt. And this month, the court has considered some of those petitions. For more, I'm joined now by Allison Herrera, who covers Indigenous affairs in Oklahoma. Allison, it is great to have you back on The Takeaway. All right, this is a pretty complex decision. Can you help by explaining some of the central components of it?
Since that ruling, as you pointed out, there's been some very spotty communication between these tribal nations and the Attorney General's office. Former Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter had a little bit more of a congenial relationship with the tribes. I mean, they disagreed on some things about, you know, how to implement the decision. And then he stepped down. He resigned last year. And then Governor Stitt appointed Attorney General John O'Connor, which he took a harsher stance. And last August, he filed a petition. They filed 45 petitions to the nation's highest court, asking them to do two things. One, narrowly rule that the state has concurrent jurisdiction, meaning they can also prosecute crimes along with the federal government and the tribes when it concerns non-Indian offenders, when they commit crimes against Indian people within the reservation. And then they're also asking the court to overturn the decision. They, as you played that clip from Stitt, said last year that the McGirt decision is the state's greatest challenge. He has said that the decision has created chaos and lawlessness. And he pointed out in that interview that I did with him that there would be thousands of cases that would be affected by this decision. And, you know, I found that statement to be rather misleading. And I think out of these petitions, 36 is the number that the nation's highest court has agreed to conference. And there could be a few scenarios coming out of that.
Okay. Give me a sense here of what is at stake. To hear the governor say that this is the greatest challenge, that it's created, you know, lawlessness in Oklahoma, right? A place where, I mean, if we start just talking about the death penalty, like, I mean, Oklahoma seems like a lot of things. Lawless is not how I would describe it. So what is at stake? Why such a powerful reaction?
I think one thing is the governor keeps saying this thing that the state needs to have one set of rules for all individuals. And I think that from the tribal nation's perspective, he fails to recognize that the tribes say that Oklahoma never had jurisdiction over the tribes. You know, when Oklahoma became a state, there was a thing called the Enabling Act. And what that did was it said, okay, we will accept you into statehood, but you have to agree that you will have no jurisdiction over tribal nations within your boundaries. And Oklahoma, you know, agreed and then violated that Enabling Act. And I think what's at stake when the governor keeps saying that it's created lawlessness and chaos is that he does create an air of uncertainty for all Oklahomans, not just tribal citizens, but all Oklahomans. And, you know, I'll read an article about McGirt and it'll say, you know, prisoner released, you know, due to McGirt. And I think what gets lost in there is that these cases are being picked up by federal courts. The tribes have to date filed thousands of cases in their own tribal courts. In that interview that I did with STIT, I mentioned what's known as cross-deputization agreements. That's things that the tribes have with local law enforcement agencies that ostensibly makes it difficult for prisoners to fall through the cracks. You know, you call 911, somebody comes to your house and helps you. And I think, you know, the reason cross-deputization agreements exist is so that that 911 call that you place doesn't, you know, they're not going to say, well, if you're a tribal citizen, you got to call the tribal police. It's like both are deputized to respond to your call, whether you're a citizen or not. And so some of that gets lost. I mean, I think, and I asked him about cross-deputization agreements and he asked me, well, are these people trained? And I kind of had to laugh because tribal police, Light Horse Police, I did a story on Light Horse Police last year. They received just the same amount of their just like your local law enforcement. There's no difference. And so I think what is at stake here when the governor says that it's created lawlessness and chaos is that it does create an air of uncertainty for people, whether that exists or not. And I think the longer that the court takes to grant or review or deny these petitions, it does leave the state in kind of a limbo. And tribes have said, you know what, we are willing to work with the governor. We are willing to work with the attorney general to iron out some of our differences. In fact, the attorney general did have a 35-minute conversation, I learned last week, with the Muscogee Nation's acting attorney general to talk about some things. I don't know quite what it sounded like, a very cordial conversation. But I think the tribes are willing to move forward in that way. And they feel that it's the governor's office that's resisting those attempts at negotiation and a way forward.
So the courts are considering right now, what are you watching for? And do you have any expectations?
Well, so they could do a few things. They've agreed to conference 36 out of those 45 petitions. One, the state has asked them to overturn the decision altogether. The second, they have asked the court to narrowly rule that they have concurrent jurisdiction under the General Crimes Act. And so the court could grant a review of the post-McGirt petition. And then again, we'll enter a period of renewed uncertainty. And then they could deny these McGirt petitions. And then what they did rule, the Supreme Court did deny three what were called post-Wallace petitions. And those petitions, these defendants had asked the court, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals made a ruling last year that said McGirt only applies after July 9th. And so these defendants were challenging that decision, saying, no, it should be retroactive. But the court denied those petitions. So that lower court ruling stands. And then the court could carry over the petitions. Again, that's another period of uncertainty. If the court denies the petitions, then presumably the rulings, you know, it's put to bed and that this is the law of the land. I mean, try to say this is the law of the land anyway. But just because they grant, if they agree to review these petitions, doesn't mean that they're overturning the decision. What it means is that it has to go through a merits phase. They have to go and argue before the Supreme Court. And then that ruling could kick into next term. So again, a period of uncertainty for citizens of the state. And I think that tribal citizens, Oklahoma citizens, I think they feel like they deserve to have closure on this issue. Or, you know, I could see if the court denies the petitions and says, no, we're not going to hear them, I could see the state filing more petitions in the next term saying, well, you got it wrong still. We're going to deny these petitions. Whether or not the nation's highest court has seen patience with that, I don't know.
Yeah, he did say say to you, endless, right? Just absolutely endless.
And he did say litigation. That. You're right. Endless yeah. litigation. It's been a long time since I've listened to that interview, but that does exactly sound like what he wants to do. And I think, you know, Oklahoma citizens are, you know, really feeling the surge of the Omicron wave, this wave of the pandemic. They're really exhausted with the people I've talked to have felt like, let's just move on. Like, you know, let's just accept the law and move on so that we can have some certainty. You know, tribal citizens obviously feel really offended by Stitt's messaging that this has created chaos. And one thing I did want to mention is that, you know, when I originally interviewed him in the summer of 2021, he said that there was going to be like 76 to 100,000 cases that were affected by this. And I scratched my head and I'm like, well, where does this number come from? You know, what? There's not that many people in the criminal justice system right now as it is. And remember that that ruling only applies to counties that were affected under the McGirt decision. And so myself and the Oklahoma Media Center, we asked the Department of Corrections for some data and found that actually it was 235 inmates within the Oklahoma criminal justice system that would be affected by this decision.
Allison Herrera covers Indigenous Affairs in Oklahoma. Thank you so much for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Recently, I sat down with Victoria Pratt, former chief judge in the Newark Municipal Courts. We discussed procedural justice and how it informed the work she did as a judge, and she offered a theory of change.
People say that change is a marathon, but when we're dealing with what's happening in the criminal justice system, I charge everyone that it needs to be a sprint, because these are lives that are being lost, and these are families, actually generations of families that are being stuck in this on this conveyor belt.
In this high-stakes marathon of change, judges play a critical role. But a new report from Square One Project at Columbia University argues that historically, judges have been resistant to change, even reforms that broaden the scope of their own sentencing discretion. The new Reimagining Judging report traces the history of judicial resistance to reform and suggests a path forward toward meaningful change. I spoke with the author of that report, Judge Nancy Gertner, professor at Harvard Law School and retired judge for the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. I asked her, what's the evidence that some judges have been historically resistant to most types of reform?
The evidence is in the resistance to, for example, compassionate release during COVID, the numbers of judges that have been unwilling to release even elderly prisoners who have had COVID. When the Supreme Court said that you can't impose life without parole for juveniles, mandatory life without parole, juveniles had to be resentenced around the country. And the sentences, really more often than I care to describe, are 30 years and 20 years. In other words, judges have been giving juveniles the functional equivalent of life imprisonment. Given that discretion to take into account all sorts of factors about adolescence and what we know about the neurobiology of adolescence, judges still default to the same numbers that they had defaulted to before that decision. And then you add to this the extraordinary resistance to the efforts of progressive prosecutors. In Massachusetts, we had a situation where a prosecutor, null prost, which is essentially wipe away a charge, which she found to have been insubstantial, and the judge rejected it, as if it was in the past, of course, a judge would go along with almost anything a prosecutor did. So, I mean, those are sort of a few examples, but it's a resistance to change that I can only describe as the habits of mass incarceration and the ways in which we are rigidified. Our views about punishment have been, after 40 years of a retributive system, have been frozen. So no longer does 1 year or 10 years seem like a legitimate sentence. 20 years must be the legitimate sentence. We're immunized to these numbers. That's what I talk about, the habits of mass incarceration die hard.
So being neither an attorney nor a judge, I'm interested in your sense of whether this resistance that we see in the existing judiciary, because it seems to me it could have a couple of different possible origins, right? One is that those who make it to the bench, either through appointment or through election, are those individuals drawn from, you know, from the possible box of judges, right, who are more retributive in their worldview sort of a priori at the beginning. The other possibility is that the experience of sitting on the bench creates, right, for, you know, if it were certainly not a random, but a random draw from the box of potential judges who are qualified, again, whether appointed or elected. And then after spending time on the bench, we see this sort of calcification of views around retributive notions of justice. Is it your sense that it's who ends up there or what happens once they are there?
I'd have to say both. Who ends up here? Up until recently, the vast majority of judges were former prosecutors. And somehow we believed that a prosecutor could move to neutral, but a defense lawyer could not. And it seems to me that already, that starts the process, because what happens is that you value, you understand, you credit the views of the prosecutor more than you credit the views of the defense. Judges become risk averse on the bench. Part of that is the way the press treats criminal justice matters. You don't want to be the judge that is written about in the morning when the guy you let go commits another crime. But the fact of the matter is that's a press issue. The press really winds up reinforcing that because it only covers, for the most part, covers instances in which someone will mess up and not the, you know, the 15 cases in which someone succeeded. So the judge gets only sort of pressure, so only influence on one side of the ledger and not on the other. And then your point was well taken. There is a socialization on the bench. Judicial neutrality, which is terribly important, oftentimes translates as not being involved in the communities that you serve. State court judges are different. Federal court judges can be at considerable distance from the communities that they serve. And that means that their vision of what's going on is filtered largely through the prosecutors and the media. They don't know the impact of the families their sentences have rent apart, or the impact of taking, you know, large numbers of men between the ages of 18 and 27 off the streets. They don't see that impact. And that calcifies, your word, very good word, that calcifies their approaches.
As you talk about that distance, right, that the notion that neutrality would require us to be distant from, not connected to the very, you know, it sometimes happens around journalism as well, right, that in order to be neutral, you need to be separate from, absent from the communities that you're covering. And I presume that in judging, much like in media, there are class and race differences between those we cover, right, those we talk about, versus the communities where judges themselves reside. How is that sort of disparate reality of judges who are mostly not poor people, mostly not people of color, making decisions, except especially in criminal court, primarily about people from poor communities and oftentimes about people who are people of color?
The easy way to put it is, if someone appears in front of you who is white, in my case, and who you sort of can make assumptions about who they are. You don't have to ask too many questions because you sort of know. If someone who comes before you is a person of color, a person who can't speak English, who's lived in communities that are very different from yours, there are lots of questions to ask. But if you believe essentially, I was a judge in the time of mandatory guidelines and mandatory sentences, if you believe that you know it all, you don't have to ask any questions. You're bound to revert to stereotypes. It's bound to happen. You're not asking the questions that you should because you don't think that you have to. So it means that then we sort of indulge in the old tropes. I'm reminded of a case I sentenced right before I left the bench of someone who had a minor drug dealer, important relationship with his son that had been over, you know, that had been, son was, it was ill, and he had a very significant relationship with his son, younger son. And the government said, "Judge, public safety demands that he be taken off the street." Mm-hmm. And I finally said, "You know, public safety actually is more complicated than that. It may require that he be taken off the street, but it seems to me it might also require that we do everything we can to preserve this family unit. That's an open question. And if you've only seen one side of the picture, it's not open to you."
And if you're assuming that you're only keeping one part of the public safe, right? And being able to think of his son as part of the public, right? Who needs safety. So let's talk a little bit about how we can begin to move towards the facilitation of meaningful change. In this new report, you outlined several recommendations for, as you call it, reimagining judging. So let's start with judicial selection and training. What do you imagine needing to change there?
People talk about diversity on the bench as if it is, you know, something that's terribly important visually, a representative. It's terribly important to have representatives. I think it's more than that. When you have people who have experienced the communities that are involved in where you sentence, where you are a judge, that's critical. I like to write about how, you know, credibility decisions are something a judge makes all the time. And because I had been a criminal defense lawyer, I understood that police officers sometimes lied. I saw it in my work. One of my colleagues said to me that he actually had never in his entire judicial career heard a police officer who lied on the stand. And I wondered whether that was a product of the fact that where he lived and the communities that he interacted with, it didn't happen. And if it didn't happen, or so he believed, that your threshold for then finding a police officer incredible is different than my threshold would be. So diversity, some sense of what the world is like, really matters. And then as well, public defenders should be on the bench, because once you get on the bench, it's important, again, that we believe that you should be dispassionate and removed from the communities you're a part of. I don't completely agree with that. But if you haven't had any experience of those communities beforehand, you get on the bench, and you're even more distant, even more away from what you should be focusing on.
You also mentioned something called sentinel event audits. What does that mean, and how could this help?
I have been struck by the way, what happens when we have wrongful convictions. So somebody is found to be innocent after years of being in prison. And we talk about what the prosecutor did. You talk about what the defense lawyer did, probation, police. We rarely talk about what the judge did. We rarely say, what was before the judge and what did he or she see or miss? I've just had that experience a few days ago. Someone was released in state court. I called up the Innocence Project and I said, "Oh my God, who was the judge?" And they said, "You, Judge Gertner." And I said, "Well, I want to go back over what happened." I had had the case on a federal appeal, and the grounds for appeal are very narrow. And it turns out the issue that tipped his conviction was not one that had been presented to me. So by sentinel event, go back and figure out how did it happen that we got it wrong, bearing in mind that all the players in the criminal justice system should go through that exercise. How did we miss this? Was it the lawyer didn't present the issue to me? What more can we do? I am accountable as a judge, one believes, only to, you know, a court of appeals. That's a different kind of accountability. That's, you know, did I follow the rules? Not did I get it right? And it could be whether I got a result that actually matched reality.
That's so helpful. I am thinking here about in the context of hospitals and medical care, that we see those grand rounds that provide also that opportunity for doctors to go back and ask, what happened when we get it wrong?
Right. What did I miss? What did I miss? And what I missed is not what legal issue, but rather, what did I miss about the person? What did I miss about the presentation? That's a different kind of accountability.
I want to go finally on this sort of, as we're thinking about how this can change, I want to go again to this question of community engagement. I have the very unique experience, well, I don't know if it's unique or not. It's an enjoyable experience for me as a parent. I have a 7-year-old who is in a Sunday school class, which now, you know, for more than a year has been meeting, you know, via Zoom on Sunday mornings. So I get to sit in on my 7-year-old's Sunday school, and it happens to be led and taught by a woman who is a judge in our community who actually just recently retired from her role as judge. But it's been fascinating to me to listen to someone I think of as, you know, the judge, right? In conversation with a group of, you know, like 6 to 12-year-olds talking about all kinds of you know, matters of how we should be and ethics. And, you know, Sunday school at that age is not high theology. It's mostly ethics, right? It's mostly like how can we be together and be good people together? And I've thought so much about not only what these kids are learning from this judge, but undoubtedly what she's learning from them when she asks them questions like, how's school going? How's, you know, how are you feeling about COVID? How are your parents, right? Just those basic getting to know you questions from these kids are undoubtedly feeding back what this judge knows, right, about the world and community that she is making decisions about. So I guess I'm wondering, what are some of the ways that we could create more opportunities for engagement that feels appropriate to us for judges to be having, but that can create some feedback loop for engagement and narrative?
Well, it's interesting. I have to start with what I know we shouldn't do. I mean, as a judge, really, in order to sort of ensure judicial independence, you're really told not to go to community events. You could go to bar association events. You could go to events with other judges. Most of the judges on my court lived in suburbia. So you literally could drive into the courthouse and not see any of the communities that you were involved with. So what does it mean? It means going to community events. It means even walking the streets to see what they are like, to go to the places that are involved. My comments, by the way, are oftentimes more related to the federalization of street crime. When federal courts began to deal with street crime, some of the issues about distance, that's what I'm mainly talking about. But, you know, going into the streets, talking to people, we found quite extraordinary attitudes that people had about the federal court, particularly dealing with drug offenses. They wanted the community to be cleaned up, but not at the price of large numbers of young men going to prisons on the other side of the country. There must be a way to talk about these issues in between that. So, I mean, I think you have to engage with the communities that you're with. I talk about a book that I'm writing about the men that I sentenced, some of whom I'm interviewing, and I gave a talk at a local community center. And one man asked me if this is essentially a reckoning, whether what I'm doing is a part of the reckoning that people are trying to come to grips with about racial issues. And I said, it's a reckoning, it's accountability, and it should be the beginning of a dialogue. And that makes all the difference in the world. We really don't understand the communities that we serve unless we have been in them.
That was Judge Nancy Gertner, a professor at Harvard Law School and a retired judge for the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. In a pandemic world where days can blend into each other with little distinction, there's one thing that makes each day unique, special, and maybe a little cultish. Wordle. Every day is a new day with a new puzzle, and 2.7 million people waiting to solve it. Created by software engineer Josh Wardle, Wordle, pun intended, is a free game that requires players to identify the 5-letter word of the day. So after you choose your first word, entering those 5 letters into individual boxes, the tiles turn various colors. That indicates which letters are in the word and which ones are not, and whether or not they're in the right place. Now you have 6 chances to guess the word, and if you do, you can share your results to social media for recognition and applause from friends and family. Now, it turns out, when they are not deep in the archives or sniffing out injustice, The producers of The Takeaway are crushing Wordle.
So I can't really give you my strategies except for one. Pay attention, because when you pay attention, there are clues to get you to the right word.
I do try to incorporate those Wheel of Fortune letters into my first word. I think they are R-S-T-L-N-E.
I'm on a one-game win streak. You have to think of a five-letter word and try to get it right within six times.
Healthy mix of vowels and common consonants is a great way to go.
I usually get it within four lines. I don't know, is that good?
I like to send those scores to some of my friends and see who wins each day.
Usually by the third or fourth word, my two-year-old is shouting letters at me.
So yes, outside the box, I love it. But if you want to hear all of our team's advice, you can check out our segment online or our podcast. But meanwhile, we have Matt Baldwin, assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Florida, because yes, clearly this is a story about the human mind and condition. Welcome, Matt. Did you play today?
Hi, Melissa. I have played. I played it right when I woke up.
Did you win?
I did win. I think I won in three tries.
Oh, okay. Smarty pants. Cool.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. Tell us why it's so popular. Why are my producers obsessed with this?
I think there's a lot of things going on psychologically in Wordle, which maybe is a testament to its success. It kind of hits like a sweet spot with a lot of things that we enjoy. But I think one of the main things is that it's a deeply social experience. So we're not just playing for ourselves, but we're playing with other people. And, yeah. You know, psychology tells us that when we all engage in sort of a common goal, which in this case, it's solving the same puzzle, then we tend to come together and feel ourselves as a big social group. And this sort of connects us together.
I'm wondering if that aspect of it is part of the pandemic appeal part as well, that, you know, in some ways, you know, pandemic sort of behavior has been sit alone in your house and, you know, binge an entire series on Netflix and, you know, in a day and a half or something. But this kind of slows you down. You can only do one a day. And it is social in that sense that everyone's doing it.
I think you're right about that. I think that on the one hand, we are craving social connection. All of our lives have basically gone virtual, and it's maybe hard to find social connection in that kind of space. But Wordle binds us together because, yeah, we're sort of all trying to accomplish the same task. And I mean, in a sense, I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but psychologists study this phenomenon. And in a way, you know, we're all sort of fighting against the puzzle, right? So in a way, we've all become friends because we're all working toward the same goal. And I think this is maybe something that we haven't experienced much of since the pandemic started, especially with lots of the division going on in society right now. Something as simple as Wordle may be bringing us all together again.
So, Matt, this point you made about having a common enemy, or at least a common task, right? Sort of trying to create dialogue, not by facing each other, but by standing next to each other and facing outward, right? Sort of directing our attention towards this task of Wordle. I mean, would that last beyond, like, if the word of the day were somehow politicized, vaccine, would it be able to last? Are those social bonds that we're creating through this kind of gaming enough to help to bridge these real divisions in society?
I think one thing that makes Wordle special is that it doesn't seem politically motivated or driven. You know, it's sort of unclear who started it and what sort of, you know, ulterior motive there might be. It's very apolitical, and it doesn't seem to have any sort of reason other than to have fun. So I think even if the word was some sort of political word, we probably wouldn't read into that too much. As far as how long that lasts, I don't know. There's a really classic study in psychology called the Robber's Cave Experiment, where a bunch of summer camp kids were given a problem to solve together at camp. And over the course of the camp, they all became friends and, you know, had to band together to solve this problem that was created by the experimenters at the summer camp. And it seemed to create a pretty lasting bond there, at least in that time period. So, I mean, this isn't necessarily a social problem we're trying to solve together, but maybe the understanding that something as simple as Wordle can at least reveal to us what we have in common and that there is still some sort of innocent, simple good in life left that we can all agree is out there. You know, maybe that's, again, something that's sort of special for us right now, and holding on to that could be something that lasts, sure.
You know, that that experiment that you just talked about and the insight from it, right, has been applied, thought about in everything from basic training for military to sororities and fraternities, right? Give folks a common task and you end up with that bond. I'm wondering if there's also something about the actual task itself that matters. So not just a task, but a word task. Does this benefit like our individual or collective minds, our brains in any way?
I think that's also a good question. So the other reason why Wordle is so fun for us, I think, is because the task itself has a kind of a perfect combination of challenge and meaning. So, you know, the words that are chosen for us to guess are not too difficult, but they're not too boring. We have kind of the perfect amount of guesses to get to the answer. So again, it doesn't get boring. It doesn't require too much of our attention and our time. So each time we play it, it's as meaningful as the time before. And the way that it's set up, where the answer is sort of slowly revealed to us, builds up this feeling of insight, or what researchers might call fluency. So as we get closer and closer to the answer, we feel like we're getting closer and closer to the truth. And when it's finally revealed, this sudden influx of insight is really rewarding to us, maybe even at the brain level. You know, it might activate that reward pathway. So I think the game itself is motivating, right? Because it feels fun and it feels good and challenging for us in the optimal way. As far as whether or not it's training our brains to be smarter in general, I don't know. The research on brain games is sort of still to be determined, I guess. But as far as what Wordle is doing for us generally, I don't know. But in terms of connecting with us on a sort of deep individual level, I think it satisfies something for us intrinsically.
Just from a, and this can be, you know, pure conjecture, but do you think it'll last or peak and then go ahead and peter out?
I think that kind of depends on whether people continue to share their experience with it on social media. So, I mean, so long as the game doesn't quote unquote sell out to, I don't know, mass advertising or something like that. Yeah, I could see it lasting for a little while.
Matt Baldwin, Assistant Professor of Social Psychology at the University of Florida. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, as promised, unabridged Wordle advice from our producers here at The Takeaway.
I love Wordle as I do all word games, and I'm super competitive. So I can't really give you my strategies except for one. Pay attention, because when you pay attention, there are clues to get you to the right word.
I don't have a super specific Wordle strategy, but I do try to incorporate those Wheel of Fortune letters into my first word. I think they are R-S-T-L-N-E. Sometimes I try to get, you know, figure out the vowels in the first word or two. Usually by the third or fourth word, my two-year-old is shouting letters at me to try. And then I get frustrated by the fourth, and then it usually clicks around four or five.
So I don't really have a strategy for Wordle, but I really do enjoy doing them. And I think it's funny and fun that they've become such a big trend and seeing everyone's scores and comparing them. I also like doing the New York Times mini crossword almost every day. And I like to send those scores to some of my friends and see who wins each day.
It's David. I'm kind of late to the Wordle party. I only found out about it this week. I'm not sure if I'm strategic. I just use logic. The first word should have several vowels and a couple of common consonants. That sets you up well. I usually get it within four lines. I don't know. Is that good?
So for a while now, people have been talking to me about Wordle, and I figured, you know what? Today's the day. I'm going to try it out. Keep in mind, I'm a 2048 kind of guy. So I log on, I win in a couple rounds, I'm on a one game win streak, and if I were to have a strategy, it would be that you have to think of a five-letter word and try to get it right within six times.
Our family plays the Wordle puzzle every day individually, but then we all compare notes after we've played. And while our teenaged boys like to start with colorful words, we do all agree that a healthy mix of vowels and common consonants is a great way to go.
All right, y'all, that's the ball game for this Thursday takeaway. Now, I'm taking a day tomorrow, but WNYC's Arun Venugopal is here with you in the host chair. So make sure you hang out with him for a little bit of politics. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.